Welcome to The Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. James Howard Kunstler's The Wong Emergency, originally published in 2005, quickly became a grassroots hit. Kunstler's vision of our post-oil future caught the attention of environmentalists and business leaders alike and stimulated widespread discussion about our dependence on fossil fuels and on dysfunctional financial and government institutions. In his new book, Too Much Magic, Kunstler evaluates what has changed in the last 7 years. He argues that the time for magical thinking and hoping the miracles is over, and the time to begin preparing for the Wong emergency has begun. James Howard Kunstler is the author of 11 novels, 4 nonfiction books. He's become a key commentator on the future, profiled in The New Yorker, and invited to speak at TED and other events across the country. It's a great pleasure to have James Howard Kunstler on The Book Show. Thank you very much for being here, Jim.
A pleasure to be here with you, Joe.
This all stems from the Wong emergency, and I just want to kind of set that up first before we talk about what's in this book, because just by the title, The Wong Emergency, we realize that what we had 7 years ago that you write about is our new reality.
Yeah, and that reality is changing very fast. You know, we're moving from one way of life and one paradigm and one era of world history to a very different one.
And we would love to say, and it's getting better.
Well, I think it's going to be kind of troublesome, problematical, and difficult for a while. But I do think that there are going to be a lot of compensations for that in the way we lead our lives. When we get past some of the new obstacles that we've placed in our way to happiness.
In this book, you really build on the arguments that you made in The Wong Emergency and use that book as this book's core.
Yeah. Well, the main argument is that because of the global energy predicament, we're probably not going to be able to generate the kind of wealth that we have been used to generating for a few hundred years. And because of that, our economies are going to enter a period of compressive contraction. This is not the same as a recession. It's a kind of a permanent situation. And it's not going to be mitigated by technological tricks. And that's the part that we can't get over right now. We're basically kicking back, waiting for Santa Claus to deliver a set of rescue remedies that will allow us to keep running Walt Disney World, the interstate highway system, Walmart, and suburbia by other means. And the key to understanding where we're at is simply this. We're going to be disappointed by what these other things can do for us, in particular alternative energy. And I want to be clear because I don't want to be misunderstood about this. I'm not against alternative energy, but I think that we're going to be disappointed by what it can actually do for us, and we're not going to do it at the same scale that we're fantasizing about now.
I find it interesting because I'll hear your work quoted where people will say, this is what Jim Kunstler says on the Wong emergency, and this is what can happen. This is why we should go fracking.
Well, no, I'm not endorsing fracking. And in fact, I think the whole shale gas, shale oil industry is in itself a kind of a Ponzi scheme bubble, which is going to end up disappointing people, especially the gas part.
And this is the magic you were referring to, the magical thinking that one size fits all, and this is the silver bullet that we've been waiting for.
Oh, yeah, the so-called game changer. That's another term that we hear all the time. And, you know, it's really, it's sheer nonsense. But, you know, that message is coming from the highest places in the land, including the president of the United States, who told the public, erroneously, I believe, that we have 100 years of shale gas. I think we're going to be disappointed to find out that that's not the case. But what it points to is a comprehensive failure of leadership in America, not just in politics, but in business and in the media and in academia and really, you know, just about everywhere. We are not able to construct a coherent consensus about reality. And because of that, we are not able to fashion a vision of how to go forward from here. That vision, by the way, I think would be kind of at odds with a lot of our wishes and expectations, because it's going to be a more rigorous life going forward. But we don't really want to hear about that.
You make the point in the book, again, too much magic, this wishful thinking, and how much of that wishful thinking comes from technology, that we have this mindset that whatever problem we have, we can take care of through some sort of technological means.
And it blows back on us constantly. You know, my favorite comical example of this is what happened with the telephone system, where, you know, we spent about $30 billion and about 30 years computerizing every phone system in America in order to improve communication. And what's the net effect of that? You can't get a live human being on the phone anywhere in America anymore. And moreover, you know, every time you sit down to dinner, you get robots calling you on the phone. You know, and then you find yourself in the ridiculous situation of having to argue with a robot. But you know what? What really amuses me is who are the people? What is the kind of personality that actually stays on the phone with a robocaller after ascertaining that a robot is calling them? You know, and what really makes it worthwhile for the companies to do this? So it's a big mystery.
When you look at technology, and because there is something there, right? I mean, we do have the means. It's just the misuse of that.
No, I don't think it's that simple. For one thing, well, let's just start from a fundamental kind of basis. I believe that as a society gets more distressed, the delusional thinking rises in exact proportion to the distress that the society feels. And we're pretty stressed out now in America for lots of reasons. And the magical thinking and delusional thinking is pretty high. One of the sort of fundamental ideas out there that's incorrect is that energy and technology are substitutable for each other. That if you run out of one, you just plug in the other. And, you know, we're going to find out the hard way that that's not true.
You talk about in the book how we have to become comfortable with reality and this reality, and that this impacts everything we do, how we eat, how we drive, how we work, and that we have to get used to that. And I assume for many people, myself included, of course, that we become comfortable and we don't want that much change.
Of course, I think that's a perfectly normal human response to, you know, to everyday reality in life. But the mandates of reality don't care that much about our wishes and inclinations. You know, they will compel us to do what we have to do, whether we like it or not. The whole driving thing is one of the more interesting elements of this. You know, I just came back from the Aspen Environment Forum, which I've been to three times now. And, you know, that's an interesting example of the failure of leadership, because at that place, you get the cream of the environmental intelligentsia. And whenever the subject of, you know, our oil problems come up you know, anything related to energy, the only thing they want to talk about is how to run the cars by other means. But, you know, the basic assumption is we're going to continue running all the cars. And, you know, it's sort of fundamentally insane that because, first of all, it does nothing to mitigate our problems with car dependency in general, you know, which carries a whole set of problems in and of itself, you know, of being, you know, stuck in this incredibly wasteful and demoralizing and economically untenable suburban paradigm, which we're just going to have to move away from, whether we like it or not. What a lot of people don't understand is that the motoring model of, you know, what I call happy motoring is going to fail by other means than just the fuel that runs the engine. One of the biggies is going to be something that also is a fundamental issue right now and is going to get more and more important as we go along. And that's capital scarcity, the scarcity of money, the inability to form capital and generate wealth as we move forward into this period of history. And so what we're going to see is there's going to be less money. There will be fewer car loans for people to buy cars. And that's the normal way that Americans buy cars. So Americans will buy fewer cars. And incrementally, that will end up, you know, becoming obvious and take a toll on people. Another way we're going to see that is that because of these capital scarcities, governments at every level are broke. You know, at the county level, the state level, the municipal level, the federal level. And we're not going to have the money to continue to maintain the incredibly elaborate hierarchy of roadways that we have assembled over the last 90 years. And, you know, we're going to see that happening, too. And so it's, you know, that whole part of the kit of parts for happy motoring is going to get into trouble. So it's not just about the fuel that you put in your tank. It's about whether the whole system itself can keep going forward.
And that system going forward, you write about in the book about cities and these large, sprawling cities that, as you say, simply have achieved such a scale that's inconsistent with the resource realities. And so the question is, at what point do we learn that? It seems like we're learning that now, but we're still stuck with the stuff, right?
Well, I think the recognition of what's going on with that has been very slow to capture people's consciousness. Mm. Manifestly, American cities have been going through this process at very different rates. You know, places like Detroit and Cleveland, those places have been in desolation for years and years. There are other places like New York City, and Washington that people consider to be hugely dynamic. But I think the bottom line is this, first of all, I think categorically you can say the suburbs in one way or another are going to fail. They're going to fail economically. They're going to fail logistically. But the big, giant metroplex cities are going to get into trouble for other reasons, which you've already stated. They are not scaled to the resource realities of the future. They're not going to be able to pay to repair themselves and for the mega systems that they depend on. And, there's another problem that I've been kind of preoccupied with lately, because I consort with a lot of urban design people. And that's the problem of skyscrapers, which I'm convinced are going to be, they're obsolete. And yet we keep on building more of them. And what we're going to discover is that they're obsolete not because of the heat and air conditioning issues or the elevator issues or, the electrical issues. They're going to be obsolete because we will never renovate them. The capital's not going to be there. The money's not going to be there to fix them. They'll have one generation of life. And you cannot have cities composed of buildings that have only one generation of life. I mean, it's in the nature of cities that they have to constantly renew themselves. So what I think we're going to see, the upshot of that, is that there will be huge demographic movements. Our big cities will contract. Our suburbs will get into the trouble that they'll get into. And eventually, people are going to be moving to smaller cities, smaller towns, the places that have been largely deactivated and depopulated for decades, and the places that have a meaningful relationship with agriculture, because growing food closer to home is going to be a big issue, and the places that are located on inland water transportation routes, because that's going to become hugely important as the trucking industry fades away, and places that are located near good rail lines, and we're going to have to fix those rail lines, and probably not do high speed. We're going to be disappointed by that, too, because the money's not there. So there's a whole set of dynamics going on here, which, basically suggests that how we occupy the landscape in America is going to be changing quite a bit in the next couple of decades.
James Howard Kunstler is the author of Too Much Magic, Wishful Thinking, Technology, and the Fate of the Nation. The book is published by Grove Atlantic, and he is our guest on the book show this week. It seems as though when we talk about your work and people say, James Howard Kunstler, best known for The Wong Emergency. You've been writing about these issues for a long time. And when you were just talking about suburbia, you wrote Geography of Nowhere,
1993.
Yeah, so almost 20 years ago.
Yeah.
And I have two questions for you. One is, as I mentioned in the introduction, you are often asked to commentate on the future. You write about the future. So what is it like to be right?
I'm not right that quickly enough, so that, people are always twanging on me for being late or for, calling things too soon, but.
But you don't want to be right.
Well, I'm not that concerned about being right, just like I'm not that concerned about being validated personally about my work. I learned a long time ago when I embarked on a career as just a professional writer to learn how to work in a vacuum. Mm. I don't show my manuscripts to my loved ones and my friends as I'm writing them. I think it's it's important to protect yourself that way. And, I do what I do. I try to generate a vision of my culture and my economy and my community that is consistent with what's really going on in the universe. And, I put it out there for people to, take it for what it's worth and compare it with their view.
But do you find it troubling that nearly 20 years ago you were writing about suburbia and how we would not be able to sustain that? And in this book, Too Much Magic, you're still talking about the magical thinking that will somehow keep suburbia alive.
Well, first of all, the inertia in our culture and in our economy is huge. There's just so much stuff out there, and there's already so much wealth out there. And, there's a tremendous amount of momentum that's keeping it going. Psychologically, what you've got is this phenomena that I call the psychology of previous investment, which means that you've already put so much of your society's wealth in a certain infrastructure for daily life that you can't even imagine letting go of it. And so what we're seeing, especially in politics, which is kind of the articulation of the public will, what we're seeing there is we're ramping up a campaign to sustain the unsustainable at all costs. We're going to do everything we can to sustain the happy motoring system and suburbia and the chain stores and the strip malls and, the big centralized school systems and all those things which are now part of the matrix of daily life in America. Now, the fact that reality may have a different view of where it's taking us, that's something that we're going to have to adjust to. And it's going to be difficult. And, big imperial, successful, gigantic cultures and societies over time they settle into a way of doing things, and then they have a hard time adjusting to new realities. It's sort of the story of story of human history.
So let us focus on that for a moment, because I find this fascinating. I ask this question a lot of my guests, and I find it to be an interesting one, and that is, what do we learn, and do we learn from our mistakes? But it seems, even if you look in our most recent history, you say, okay, this is the way we're going to do things, and then someone says, oh, but we have to worry about the environment and climate change and global warming, and these are things that we have to concern. And you feel, okay, we've been smacked upside the head, and we have to take notice. And then we don't really do anything, and nobody says anything. And then the economy tanks in 2008, and you think, okay, well, this is a wake-up call. Everything's going to change. This is going to be amazing. And nothing really happens there. And you get smacked upside the head again. But the question being, what do we learn from that, and why don't we learn from that?
Well, Joe, I'd argue with you that we're not actually being smacked upside the head, at least most people. Really what's happening is that reality is only whispering in our ears, which is, not as urgent as being smacked upside the head. Well, when history smacks you upside the head, that's when you don't get any dinner. That's when there's no food in the refrigerator. That's when, that's when your society is very disorderly and people are running around, misbehaving.
But that gets into the inertia that you were talking about before. I mean, to me, when someone says that our planet is warming, I mean, that is something that's serious. When somebody says, okay, well, there are people who aren't able to get a meal because the economy is suffering, so we may not immediately feel it, but we see our brothers and sisters out there who are feeling it.
Well, these things sort of begin on the margins of life and the margins of wealth, and then they move inward to, and that's what's happened with the process of the disappearing middle class in America. It's moved from the underclass to now the middle class is beginning to suffer, fundamentally. Not enough food, no income, not able to buy clothing. What's kept it going for the last 4 or 5 years, since the banking disorders of 2008, is nothing more complicated than accounting tricks. That's really, when we talk about financial innovation and financial engineering, really what has been engineered in the last 10 years mostly are new sets of accounting trickery, sometimes using computers, that have allowed us to pretend that we're still wealthy, when in fact we're going broke and money is disappearing. And that's allowed us to sort of pretend that we can keep having that same kind of economy. And people, it's the reality is, a lot of people do have food in the refrigerator now, and they do have a job, and they do have a paycheck. But, you know, what we're going to see is at the margins, the money is going to be the money is going to be disappearing. The jobs will be incrementally disappearing, going closer to the center of life. And, you know, there are going to be a lot more people who are visibly suffering.
What is so troubling about that, and what I find so troubling in reading the book, is that this is global.
Yeah.
You really can't escape this.
No, although, you know, I think that we'll see somewhat different outcomes in different places, and there will be better places than others, you know, and that goes for the United States in particular. You know, ever since the long emergency, I've made the point that I think, for example, the Sun Belt is going to suffer in exact proportion to the degree that it prospered the previous 40 years. So, you know, I think that places like Dixieland are going to be very difficult places to live. You know, they're going to be disorderly socially. They're going to have trouble with their economy. You know, one of the dirty secrets of the American economy, and especially in the Sun Belt for the last 30 years, has been it's mostly been about creating suburban sprawl, about building new places and building new strip malls and new housing subdivisions. And that's over. We're done doing that. So that whole economy is vanishing down there. You know, but there are other parts of the United States that I think are very undervalued, in particular our part of the country, the Great Lakes region, and other parts of the upper Midwest, places that have water, places that have good farmland. You know, I think those are going to be the successful places, you know, in direct proportion to their, you know, their recent failure the last half century.
The dysfunction in politics that you write about, that you say has held us hostage, given the circumstances and what has happened through this quote-unquote long emergency, that seems inevitable, doesn't it, that dysfunction?
No, I'm not sure that it does have to. I'm not sure that we have to be as paralyzed and inept and as incompetent as we have been. I voted for President Obama, but I don't have any credible explanation for why he didn't send a memo to the Justice Department to begin prosecuting financial fraud and misconduct on Wall Street. I mean, that's a terribly corrosive thing. When the rule of law vacates the financial sphere, and that lack of trust starts to infect all the other authorities and institutions in our life, including, you know, our government and education and everything that really requires some kind of vested authority to work properly, you know, starts to corrode. And so I think that there are tremendous repercussions from President Obama's failure to pursue the prosecution of misconduct in financial matters.
So we have a minute left, and we've been talking about dire things and the fate of this nation and the failure of wishful thinking. Where do you find, or can you find, optimism?
Well, yeah, I wrote a couple of novels in between The Long Emergency and Too Much Magic because I wanted to vividly portray what my vision of the future would be. So I wrote World Made by Hand, right, and The Witch of Hebron. And, you know, that is represents a major reset of American life and of civilized life in general at a much sort of lower scale and lower level and lower tempo than what we're used to. You know, these are people who are now living in an economy that's mostly centered on agriculture. And, you know, they don't enjoy the blandishments of canned entertainment and the internet, and the electricity is not working too well. And, you know, I think we're heading into that kind of world made by hand. But, you know, it doesn't scare me. I think there will be huge compensations for us in, you know, returning to true ideas of community and working with our neighbors and making music with our neighbors.
James Howard Kunstler's new book is Too Much Magic, Wishful Thinking, Technology, and the Fate of the Nation. Jim, it's always a pleasure to have you on the program.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
Thanks so much. Again, Too Much Magic, published by Grove Atlantic. We enjoy hearing from our listeners about our shows. You can email us at book@wamc.org. You can listen again or find past book shows at wamc.org. Sarah LeDuc produces our program. Bookmark us for next week. And thanks for listening for The Book Show. I'm Joe Donahue.